about the place. I imagine he'll have some excellent guests to converse with, and so I'll be producing that remotely, just like we do your show, John, and just like we do your show, Peter. And well, John, you know all about it because we've already done all the tech together.
Oh yeah.
So it should be a lot of fun.
And it's, John, thank you for fixing my board. Thank you.
That's all right. You know, Guy doesn't usually go on Fridays, but there will be a special Friday Guy James show as he continues broadcasting live from Washington, D.C. So I hope everybody will be on board for that when it comes around at 3 p.m. Eastern time beginning tomorrow. But anyway, you slice it.
And for folks that don't actually tune into my show on a regular basis, Monday's show on my show is going to be a special annual event because it's going to be the Australian Invasion Day show. And we've got some really, really interesting history on the Aboriginal tribes that inhabited the area in which I live and what the colonists, or actually the prisoners, did to them. It's not to be missed.
Nice people, those. All right. Well, it sounds wonderful. Thanks, Peter. Thanks, John. You make it so much fun. And in closing, here's the late, great Lowell George reminding you to...
This is a top to what we use on stage, but it's very, very special because if you can see, the numbers all go to 11. Look, right across the board, 11, oh, 11,
and most
11,
of the amps go up to 10.
Exactly.
Does that mean it's louder? Is it any louder?
Well, it's one louder, isn't it? It's not 10. You see, most blokes, you know, be playing at 10. You're on 10 here, all the way up, all the way up, all the way up. You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
Welcome to Conversation Radio's Lean, Mean, and Green Show right here on the Horn. It's Boxed Up with John Fox, where we turn the conversation to conservation. Boxed Up is brought to you by B1 Louder Productions in Sydney, Australia, and CityNet, citynet.net. B1 Louder by ringing 877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 877-443-2366, or use your free minutes by dialing direct 304-658-5453. Yeah. Your host, the ranting, head-banging hippie, John Fox.
All right, everybody, welcome aboard Foxed Up here for another rousing show. And as I mentioned earlier, you got to tune in to Monday's show, Tuesday here in Australia. It's going to be the annual Invasion Day broadcast, known by the white people here as Australia Day. Gail, my wonderful partner in this life, has done some amazing research on the subject and has found some amazing websites with accounts of the early times in this area known as Bennelong in Australia. And I think it's gonna make last year's Invasion Day show seem lightweight. But that's for Monday. We're gonna talk about King Cole today, but that's gonna come up in a little bit. First, we have our track of the day, which we're gonna do, and this album has to be very possibly number one on my Desert Island Discs list. This album, I mean, you all know me for, you know, banging away on a guitar and whatnot, but I did start my musical life as a drummer, and I studied for 20 years with private teachers, and drums were my life. And if there's any album that lays out the greatest studio drummers of the 70s, which is when I first started playing, Steely Dan's Asia is it. And the reason why this is come up is I've mentioned before there's this great documentary series, which you can find some of them on Google Video, called Classic Albums. And last night they were doing Steely Dan's Asia, and I thought that the glossing over of the title track, or kind of, they barely touched on it, and I thought it was there was a great omission, because they talked about all the great drummers that played on it: Rick Marotta, Purdy, you know, just amazing players, Jim Keltner on Peg. But the track of tracks is the title track, Asia. And it was played by God, Mr. Steve Gadd. And you'd speak to drummers, and really the most influential drummer of the modern era, hands down, is Steve Gadd. You'd be familiar with him from, you know, great Paul Simon tracks, Late in the Evening, 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover. He's, you know, very non-traditional playing style. He played drum corps as a kid, so hence the somewhat kick and snare marching style that would kind of come out in a lot of his playing. And the thing about when Steely Dan was doing Asia, it was rather a hired gun machine. And what would really happen, the normal course of events, is that the sessions were 6 hours long, 3 hours, a lunch break, and then 3 hours. And basically, the first 3 hours was teaching a band the songs, and then after lunch, they'd go and track. And the engineer and the producer who were involved, you know, didn't know that they didn't know the vision that the boys had. They knew what they wanted to hear, and they could go through an entire day doing a song with a band, and at the end of the day they'd go, no, that's not it, and the next day would be a completely different band doing the same songs. Now, there's a lot of legend around this, and On the Road pops in saying Buddy Rich and Gene Krupa are the modern era. I do agree, and Buddy Rich is still, to me, the greatest drummer that ever walked the planet. But, you know, I'm talking kind of modern era, kind of from this, you know, 1970 on. And there are legends that say that Steve Gadd came in and did the Asia track in one take. Whether this is true or not, I don't know. And the rest of the band had to recut their parts. It's not that you're old on the road. You just remember good drummers. I love big band. We'll play some Buddy Rich next week. Because I've just been actually had some classic things returned to my collection that I hadn't seen in a long time, like Plays and Plays and Plays and The Best Band I Ever Had. There are stories that, you know, supposedly they cut out the individual tracks from the different master tape cuts and reassemble the master and all that kind of thing. But I don't care how it happened. This is, to me, Steve Gadd at his absolute most genius. A class guy, some of the best chops that ever was, and I guarantee you that I from all my years doing production, I think that this album, the Asia album, has been used to fire up more PA systems on this planet than any other record. Because it's still, engineering-wise, I still think it's timeless. And there, you know, even Michael McDonald talking on classic albums last night was saying that, you know, he did the really tight harmonies that are on the track. And he also did them on Peg and a couple of others. And he said he had never had to sing all the parts of something where the intervals were so close together, and it was a real challenge for him. And one thing I didn't know about the track, though, which was mentioned last night, that it actually comes from a number of different songs that they had written, and they ended up kind of putting them together as one piece and turning it into a mini suite. And that's really what it is. And I had a drum teacher for a long time, a guy by the name of Dave Yee, and he was a big percussionist in the New York studio scene. He was a wonderful teacher. His mother was actually my third grade school teacher. And he used to hand write out all these charts, and I think he charted out the entire Asia album because it was just this well of great drummers and great performances. So, and I'll never forget. There's two kind of solo sections towards the end. There's actually, I think, three, and underneath the sax solo, Gadd just lets loose. And I'll still remember the chart that the first two sections my teacher charted out note for note, and then it got to the third section and he just wrote out the horn rhythm kicks, and there was a little note that said, if you get this far, you're on your own. And I worked on it for years on and off and got it pretty damn close. I aside from that last solo, I could probably still sit down and almost play it. It's kind of that much of my... It's that ingrained in my brain, you know. They were watching the program last night. I haven't listened to the album in a while, and every track came up, and I can remember every lyric, you know. And Steely Dan lyrics can sometimes be a bit obscure. And yes, David Fremaine, Bill Bruford, there's another one. I mean, the list is endless of great drummers. But I gotta say, Steve Gadd, he still is gotta be when it comes to style and execution and whatnot. He really is personally one of my favorites, and he's just absolutely, you know, in the drummer's world we call him God, and there's a reason. Just a really unique approach to the kit. A great feel for hearing, you know, everything from a jazz fusion track to a cheesy pop song, and breaking tradition and taking it to a new place. And this track, there are these great, great rhythmic things. He pulls halftime during the verses and makes it that much more relaxed, when I guarantee you every other drummer that would have played that track would have played it straight. And he's just, you know, just a genius. So, you know, if you want to, if you have a young drummer in your family and he doesn't know about Gadd, you got to expose him. And I guarantee you can find charts on the web of 50 ways to leave your lover in late in the evening and just start there. They are so much fun. He's fun to play and always had one of the best drum sounds ever. So without further ado, from the most awesome Steely Dan album, Asia, from 1978, the title track, Asia, with Mr. God Steely Dan. Roll it, Bob.
Up on the hill, people never stand, they just don't care.
Now that is genius. And Bob's just forwarded me an email from David in Tennessee, and he makes some very, very good, he makes a couple of great suggestions, talking about young drummers. He says, but really, if you want a kid that is studying to come forward well-listened, Ricky Fattar for feel, especially blues, and Vinnie Colaiuto. And Vinnie Colaiuto, I will go, oh, yeah. He's a great man to study. And he's just... Vinny's one of my favorites, too. He did some Steely Dan stuff as well. I think he might have even played on Reelin' in the Years, but don't quote me on that. Vinny's a monster. But see, that was the thing about Steely Dan. You know, after two albums of touring, they realized that touring wasn't the thing that they wanted to do. They wanted to create something other. So when they pulled themselves off the road, they lost most of the back, you know, Brecker and whatnot. They lost the band, pretty much. And so then it became this studio thing where they created something that I don't think has ever quite been done since. Plenty of David from Tennessee. Ricky Rocket from Poison. No one could twirl better. I think you just set a volume with that, man. See, I was playing during, you know, that was really during, you know, my heyday. You know, all that stuff, and it so stopped being about the playing and about image, and look at where it's gotten us. And it's gotten us to things like American and Australian Idol. I'm sorry, Billy Shears, I know you love your American Idol, but I'm not going to mention a name, but I found there was a very interesting bit of information passed on to me this past weekend. A former Australian Idol competitor who has had a fairly decent career since, you know, being plugged by Sony BMG and the fact that, you know, he's camera friendly. But a friend of mine had a really, really great song that was offered to him. And his rule is, unless the composer gives him a writing credit, he won't take the song. That's manufacturing credibility. And that's what's happened to mainstream music. Manufactured credibility. And David, you're absolutely right. American Idol is toxic. Australian Idol's been toxic for the Australian music industry. It's horrible. It's horrible. And the fact that Sony and BMG were allowed to merge is one of the greatest crimes to music. They should never have been allowed to merge. When one company can control 90% or better of the distribution of all music in a country, you know that your choices are going to be very limited. And, you know, would a band like Steely Dan be able to do what they did today? I don't think so. I think it wouldn't happen, you know, to be able to, you know, go, no, we didn't really like that band. Let's get a whole other band and try that song again and have the vision come complete. And you know, aside from it being, you know, a sweatshop for music, what I find really sad is it just seems to be a way for now defunct, useless, you know, out of their prime pop stars to have their songs regurgitated. It takes no effort. It takes no creativity. You go, oh, we're going to do this song. You know this song. Here's a chart. Play it straight. We'll doctor it up and call it new. And you know, I mean, I seriously, you know, watched, and a country as small as Australia in population, you can see it, I think, even more dramatically than in a place like the United States, just due to sheer population, how things like Australian and American Idol have, you know, ended up dominating the industry because you have all this television cross-promotion crap that goes on. And, you know, and you know, the police are over here at the moment. And although I think Sting's gotten a little up himself in later years, I still have a lot of respect for both Sting and the police. And touring with the police is Sting's son's band. And I found it very, very interesting to hear that when he was first asked to open up for his dad down here, he said, hell no, I won't go. Because he didn't want to come off as having manufactured his credibility. Now, his band's been playing for years doing gigs. Doing it the hard way. Doing it the real way. And I saw them perform on television this morning, and they were good. I mean, this boy sounds and looks a hell of a lot like his father. And I can see not wanting to be labeled as Sting's kid. But he's got the chops. He's got the songwriting. But when his band found out about him turning down the offer, they're going, what, are you nuts? And his band talked him into it. And I saw Sting interviewed over here, and he said, look, he didn't want to do it. But if you're coming to the gig, watch the set. He said, he stands on his own two feet, and you'll have no doubts about it. And I got to give him credit. You know, he resisted hard. And it would have to be a hard thing to pass up, to go out on probably what is the biggest reunion tour in the past year. The only thing that could possibly beat it is if Zeppelin does another reunion tour this year, which I think is in the cards myself. Because almost every time they get together for a one-off, it turns into something. And, you know, and sometimes I find it unfortunate when children of really talented people end up kind of being put in the same corner as the manufactured idols. I think that's unfortunate. Because if you're surrounded by all that music and all these great players, wouldn't that be an influence and possibly create a new generation of great players? Just look at... I don't know if you've seen... And I'm so not getting to my content for tonight, but I don't care. if you've seen the concert for George Harrison that was done a couple of years ago after he died, and his son playing with all these amazing people, with that amazing portrait of George Harrison as a young man hung from high atop the venue, and his boy looks like George in the early years. But he's a fine player. He's an absolutely fine player. But I bet he hesitates to go out and do anything really big on his own because people are going to believe that he's riding on his dead father's, you know, coattails. And I don't think that is the case. And you're right, ELO. Danny is a great kid. The backstage stuff where, you know, you can see when he's hanging out with Clapton and Petty and all these people, that these were just people that were family friends. And what a way to learn to play. That concert to me is still one of the greatest things I've seen in the last few years. It's magic. It really is magic. And I'm sorry, you know, I love Ringo because he was, you know, a great, you know, I still think a very, very talented drummer and one of the best natural clocks in rock history. But George was the man. Hands down, George was the man. Anyway. Wow, I've already killed a half an hour, Bob. Why don't we take a quick break and we'll reconvene after a bit of a break and get into King Cole fighting for his dear life, and boy, is he fighting hard. So stick around, folks. You're listening to Foxed Up here on the Head On Radio Network, and we will be right back.
This is The Horn, the Head On Radio Network.
Now I lay me down to sleep.
I pray thee, Lord, my soul to keep. If I should die before I wake.
Across Appalachia, children pray at night. Coal companies are destroying Appalachia with 3 million pounds of high explosives per day. Take a stand. Go to CRMW.net, Coal River Mountain Watch. Be part of the solution so you and they can sleep at night. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net.
The trains are rolling by and I can feel the ground rumbling.
Everybody comes to Rick's.
If he can stand it, I can. Play it.
Howdy, Rangers. Tune into Rick's Place. You'll be fascinated with porn psychotherapist Rick Goodner's take on all of today's political issues from a real Texan's liberal point of view. So mosey on into Rick's Place for some good old hospitality with Rick Goodner. See you there, Rangers, this Saturday right here on the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
And if you want another kind of love, I wear a mask for you. If you want a partner, open my hand. If you want to strike me down in anger, here I stand. Yeah, I'm your man.
Don't miss Rick's Place with Rick Goodner. Part of the weekend lineup on The Horn, running all weekend in rotation with The Showers Report and Night Sounds.
Everyone loves to listen to music, but have you ever stopped to think about why it's great for kids to learn to play music? Hi, I'm Darius Rucker from Hootie and the Blowfish. These days it seems people focus way too much on the economics of school music instead of an amazing positive effect it has on kids. It's such a thrill for a child when he or she gets the first instrument or masters a simple part on the flute or performs a showstopper with a school chorus. And there's so much music out there to play and listen to. When kids learn to appreciate a show tune, a Beethoven symphony, or an opera, in addition to what they hear on the radio, it only opens their young minds to the diversity of the world around them. Make sure your kids learn to love music. Support your school music program.
A PSA brought to you by MENC, the National Association for Music Education, and the National Anthem Project, the campaign to restore America's voice through music education. March is Music in Our Schools Month.
This is The Horn, the Head On Radio Network.
That's just killer. Welcome back, everybody, to Foxed Up. Before we get into things, David makes a really, really good comment here that with the music industry today, it's all fake. And the indies are getting more attention from audiophiles and music lovers because no one wants to deal with a saturated whore. And I agree with that. And there was an interesting little story that popped up in the Sydney Morning Herald here the other day where Robert Plant was supposedly bagging Radiohead as being meaningless, unrhyming crap, and, you know, and really bagging them and a couple of other of what I think are the better bands at the moment. And I couldn't even read the article because for some reason it just struck me as not being right. And Gail had a closer look, and it was a story from The Sun in the UK. Now, this is just like a complete rag, right? And I turned to Gail and I said, you know what? I reckon that that is a completely made-up story. But Fairfax Media, who runs the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age and the Brisbane Times, ran it because they have huge advertising deals with the major labels. And I reckon, I have nothing to base this on, but this is just my feeling, that they ran that story as a way to bag the band that is, at least in the media's eyes, leading the way of the revolt against the major labels. I can't see any other reason for running a story from a very, very dodgy source like that. And that's just my take on that. Because the majors are scared. All they're complaining about downloads is, I'm sorry, it only has half the weight that they think it does. It's because they've been releasing crap for the last couple of decades. But moving on, Gene sent me this great article, and it's from Celsius.com, and this is like got to be one of the best environmental blogs out there. They do such great work. You can, you know, one really well researched and linked story can just take you many places that you didn't know to look, and it saves you a whole lot of searching. It's just one of the most fantastic blogs out there. And this is from Craig McIntosh. Saying King Cole wants to keep his crown. And it opens up saying there's a lot of pressure in the U.S. at the moment on several fronts. The presidential race is heating up as the economy is taking a steep dive. And from the BBC, they have a quote here saying, unfortunately, they have no power to reverse what, in my opinion, is the worst post-war recession, said Michael Metz, chief investment strategist at Oppenheimer in New York. And he continues, meanwhile, in the midst of this climate, some of the richest, most powerful industries are shifting nervously in their seats, notably big coal and big oil. In the wake of the IPCC report, public opinion is playing catch-up with the science, and this is translating into increased concern over our old-fashioned embedded energy choices. The practical outcome of this shift in public understanding has been evidenced by major obstacles being put forth in the way of new coal-fired power plants for Washington State, Florida, Kansas, and Texas. And I went and checked these out. And I mentioned not about a year ago, I think, that here in Australia, an activist got a new coal mine blocked because he proved that the permit had to take into effect the carbon created when it was burned after it was sold in China. So you actually having to look long term at what you're doing. And so from SeattlePI.com, in Olympia, state energy regulators have stopped the permit application for a coal-fueled power plant in southern Washington until the builder meets requirements of a new climate change law. In an order issued Tuesday, the State Energy Facility Site Evaluation Council has suspended the application from Energy Northwest until the Public Power Consortium addresses how it will sequester carbon emissions. Ha ha ha! You have to prove the myth! Energy Northwest pollution control plans for the proposed Kalama plant say that carbon sequestration, a process for trapping greenhouse gases in the earth, remains unworkable in real-world practice. So until it is workable, the utility wants to pay to offset emissions. The council rejected that approach, stating that in a 12-page order that it fails to meet the plain language of the statute. It's planned to prepare a plan at some indefinite later date. So we're seeing states not falling for the spin of it, which I find just unbelievably good. And then in Tampa Electric Shelf plans Thursday for a $2 billion power plant. This is from October 5 last year. The third coal plant in Florida since June to derail amid concerns about how to deal with gases believed to cause global warming. Combined, the three canceled plants would have produced enough electricity to power 2 million houses, nearly a quarter of the homes in Florida. Their failure raises a new questions about how the state will balance its growing electricity needs against Governor Charlie Crist's aggressive goals to cut greenhouse gas emissions and expand the state's use of renewable power. Crist said Thursday evening that he was pleased with Tampa Electric's decision if it means they will turn to a cleaner fuel than coal. I'm not a fan of coal, he reiterated. He pointed to the expansion of nuclear power, as well as recently announced solar and biomass projects as examples of clean, reliable, affordable energy. I'll pull the nuke thing out of there. I think he's missing the point there. But, hey, stopping the coal's good. And then from Kansas, maybe there isn't... Hey, there's something not wrong with Kansas, folks. KDHE denied Sunflower Electric air quality permit. Roderick L... this is from also in October last year. Roderick L. Bremby, Secretary of the Kansas Department of Health and Environment, announced today that he has denied the air quality permit of the two proposed 700-megawatt generators at the Sunflower Electric Power Corporation near Holcomb. A careful consideration of my responsibility to protect the public health and the environment from actual threatened or potential harm from air pollution. I've decided to deny the Sunflower Electric Plant Corporation. Notice the shiny little name. It's the Sunflower Electric Company building coal-driven plants. It's a sunflower. In making his decision, Bremby cited the authority provided to the Secretary of KDHE in KSA blah 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 and KSA blah 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 A, which grant him the authority to affirm, modify, or reverse a decision on air quality permit after the public comment period or hearing, and KSA blah blah blah, which authorized him to deny or modify an air quality permit to protect the health of persons or the environment. And then, shock of shocks, from the Dallas News, also in October, plans for 8 Texas coal plants formally canceled. The company, once known as TXU Corp., on Monday formally canceled applications to build 8 coal-fired power plants. Energy Futures holding power plant businesses called Luminant said it began the process of terminating the applications before the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality as promised. The new owners of the state's largest utility, Kohlberg, Kravitz, Roberts & Company, and TPG, had pledged to cancel plans to build 8 of 11 coal-fired power plants to win support for the proposed buyout when it was announced in February. TXU's coal plant project had prompted protests from environmental groups, politicians, and business leaders fearing pollution. And this only means that the coal mafia of the United States is going to fight even harder. And just bear with me a moment because, well, I closed a wrong tab. So as I get it back, because this has brought on a huge amount of backlash from the coal industry. They ain't happy. They might be finding that their money is going to start buying less and less public opinion. There's a statement here in the Post from Common Dreams that says some voters are responding. In truth, 2008 is the year of the coal reckoning. The construction of new coal-fired plants are being fought in nearly 30 states across the country. Take Kansas, thanks to a citizens' movement and so-called red state. The so-called red state became the first in the nation to reject efforts build more coal-fired plants due to considerations of carbon dioxide emissions. Across Appalachia and the South, an extraordinary crossover campaign of citizens groups have launched one of the most aggressive anti-strip mining movements in history. Their campaign has gone national, and we know who those people are. Some of them are our dear friends at Coal River Mountain Watch, the folks at I Love Mountains. And so I really think, I was saying this to Nanette yesterday, I really do believe this year your cause is going to get serious national traction, and it's because of the grassroots movement. And it's and so I really do believe that, you know, it's going to get traction. And when people start to see what's happening, not only the carbon aspect of it, but what's happening to the Appalachian Mountains is going to create national outrage. But McIntosh continues and says, "Few monarchs have ever stepped down from positions of power willingly. And King Cole is certainly no exception, and he certainly has the weapons of warfare with which to preserve his place in the market, political connections and money. Knowing that the push against dirty fuels will only snowball, the coal industry is not content to sit idly, watching profits get diluted as funds are redirected towards a cleaner, greener future." And from the Washington Post, a group backed by the coal industry and its utility allies is waging a $35 million campaign in primary and caucus states to rally public support for coal. Like Friends for Coal, Friends of Coal, whatever that crap is that sponsors all your sporting events out there, Bob. Public support for coal-fired electricity and to fuel opposition to legislation that Congress is crafting to slow climate change. The group called Americans for Balanced Energy Choices has spent 1.3 Balanced Energy Choices, isn't that Orwellian? Has spent $1.3 million on billboard, newspaper, television, and radio ads in Iowa, Nevada, and South Carolina. One of its television ads shows a power cord being plugged into a lump of coal, which it calls an American resource that will help us with vital energy security. Using security. And the fuel that powers our way of life. The ads note that half of U.S. electricity comes from coal-fired plants. The lobbying group doesn't hesitate to be disingenuous in its marketing campaign either. As ads being run by Americans for Balanced Energy Choices talk about clean coal, new power plants are cleaner than they used to be because they must meet more stringent federal regulations, limiting such pollutants as nitrogen oxides and sulfur dioxide. But climate change is linked to carbon dioxide emissions, which are not yet regulated. Those emissions have dropped more modestly as plans to become more efficient. The group's newspaper ads avoid this distinction. They say that today's carbon-fired plants are 70% cleaner based on regulated emissions per unit of energy produced. That does not refer to carbon dioxide. Also, from the Washington Post. McIntosh continues, "The brilliant marketing shill, clean coal, is of course used at every opportunity. Proposed new plants would be built carbon sequestration ready, meaning that if the ability to capture and store the plant's CO2 emissions is ever developed to the point where it's safe, i.e. won't leak or get burped out of the geological formations or be subject to mass release through a rupture from, say, an earthquake, affordable, it's become increasingly clear that carbon capture will only get implemented with massive taxpayer funding, and there's many links to check that out, and scalable to the quantities required, then it'll be incorporated. The lobbying group is very enthusiastic about the readiness of such technologies, but they rank amongst the very few that are." I mean, the whole clean coal thing is just such a bunch of nonsense. They quote the hard truths about energy from the National Petroleum Council, saying the hurdles to implementation of CCS are largely ones of integration and scale. Current possible scenarios of climate change predict that by 2030 the level of CO2 to be mitigated could be 30 billion tons per year or more. Sequestering only 5 billion tons of CO2 each year would entail pumping volumes close to 100 million barrels per day of supercritical CO2 into secure geological formations. None of this is even slightly possible. And I'm seeing Marion Delgado in the chat room. Long time no see. How are you? It's a myth. It's always been a myth. And, you know, it was only a couple of years ago, I believe it was in the UK, that a naturally occurring CO2 deposit leaked out. And it wiped out an entire village. So if we go trapping this stuff underground, and there's a seismic event, what's going to happen? It'll be a disaster. Do you want this stuff stored underneath your house? I don't think so. McIntosh continues, or it's McIntosh, I can't remember. Even the coal industry itself admits that carbon capture and storage is not, in fact, ready for implementation. That is, they admit this when trying to satisfy why carbon capture and storage is not being used on new plants today, as opposed to when they're lobbying for public support for building them. Referring to Senator Hillary Clinton, one of the founders of America's Power, an alliance of coal and energy companies, said, "Hillary recognizes the new power plants using coal can't be expected to put carbon capture and storage technologies on that don't exist yet." This is one of my major problems with Obama and Clinton. They both think that liquefied coal and sequestration are one's a good idea and the other one's feasible. Why do we not take all this subsidizing that they're looking for what could be an extremely dangerous and ineffective technology that doesn't even exist yet and put it into developing technologies that do exist and show real promise, like the SPEGS system, which is the solar geothermal bidirectional system that I covered in great depth a couple of months ago. Still got some time. Good. These contrary targeted forked tongue statements are not constrained to the U.S. only, of course, as George Monbiot discovered. And from Georgia say, aha, you say. But what about carbon capture and storage? When governments use this term, they mean catching and burying the carbon dioxide produced by burning fossil fuels. It is feasible, but there are three problems. The first is that the fossil fuels are being extracted and burnt today, and scarcely any carbon capture schemes yet exist. The second is that the technology works only for power stations and large industrial processes. There is no plausible means for catching and storing emissions from cars, planes, and heating systems. The third, as Alistair Dowling, then in charge of energy, admitted in the House of Commons in May, is that the technologies required for commercial carbon capture might never become available. The government is prepared to admit this when making the case, as Darling was, for nuclear power, but not when making the case for coal. And there's lots of money behind, too, so, but behind the both of them. So, you know, oh, I'll take money with this hand and talk out of this side of my mouth, and then I'll take money with the other hand from the other guy and talk out the other side of my mouth. Meanwhile, from the Huffington Post, Jeff Biggers brings the political line in. Let's face it, every single presidential candidate with a veritable chance at victory, Democrat or Republican, is in the hip pocket of King Cole. And there is no doubt about it. While the Americans for Balanced Energy Choices team may paint a polished veneer over their intentions, our good friends over on DSmog Blog have managed to secure a copy of their own report. A copy of their own request for proposals it used when approaching with the view to commissioning PR agencies in Nevada. The document makes clear that U.S. energy security and public and environmental health are not the priority. As part of the ABEC's broader international communications campaign, a primary objective is to defeat unreasonable regulations that negatively impact the industry. ABEC will look to the Public Relations Agency to assist in implementing communication strategies and tactics designed to assist in defeating such regulations if they arise. So in other words, they're going to try and spin it that you're hurting us and you're taking jobs. And that's so not the case. Anyone that looks at this thing honestly knows that if we put the investment into the new technologies, we're going to create more jobs than the dirty technologies are providing now. Starting to run out of time here. There's tons in this article. There's a link to it at on the show post today. Thank you, ELO, for taking care of that for me. And there's tons of links. There's a lot of really great reading here on this issue, because this is like the big lie. This whole concept of sequestration is the big lie. And here, you know, building a plant that's sequestration ready. Exactly what the hell does that mean? Sequestration ready. Oh, yeah. We've got a pipe with a valve on it in case the system ever happens. Which it won't. They know it won't. But they'll take plenty of our money in which to go forward with meaningless research. Meaningless, like the Japanese whale research. They're going to kill you while they come to a decision that it doesn't work. This stuff just drives me absolutely batty. And David, they're all son of a bitches. every last one of them. But I do think the public's catching on, and I mean, we even see places like Kansas saying, "Hey, you know, we really don't need more of this." And I bet you know some of this comes from people that live close to you know coal-driven power plants and are going, you know, I'm sick a lot. I'm really sick. And my kids are sick. And my water sucks. And, you know, sometimes you can't spin people that live in the reality. Just look at our friends in West Virginia and the surrounding states. They haven't backed down because they live in the reality. And it's bringing that reality into the view of the rest of the nation that will create the outrage that we need in which to change our ways. I think that's about all I have left to say on the subject. So thanks for being with us today, folks. Thanks to Bob for producing, as per usual. Thanks to Scott Berry at B1 Louder Productions for the music. Thank you to Coal River Mountain Watch for everything they do, and they're kicking ass. So as we say here on Foxed Up, be good, be green. We'll see you tomorrow.
If ever I would stop thinking about music and politics, I would tell you that sometimes it's easier to desire and pursue the attention and admiration of 100 strangers than it is to accept the love and loyalty of those closest to me. And I would tell you that sometimes I prefer to look at myself through someone else's eyes. Eyes that aren't clouded with the tears of knowing what an asshole I can be, as yours are. If ever I would stop thinking about music and politics, I might be able to listen in silence to your concerns, rather than hearing everything as an accusation or an indictment against me. And I would tell you that sometimes I use sex to avoid communication. It's the best escape when we're down on our